Hello, I'm Richard Ady. This is The Money. Our biggest cities are increasingly difficult to live in, and traffic congestion is a big part of why. So this week, an economics-based approach to changing that. Road charging.
What we get congestion on toll roads, and we're paying a toll for a little benefit often these days, especially in the peak. The toll is wrong.
I think the biggest problem is that there's diabolical politics around this. Normal drivers are concerned at the idea that they might have to pay additional costs. And for that reason, politicians usually think about this in terms of a trade-off.
It's about what kind of city you want to be. Do you want to be a city dominated by cars and traffic and pollution? Or do you want a livable city which people can walk around and which feels like a nice city to live, work and invest in?
Darling, can't you see my signals turn from green to red? And with you I can see a traffic jam straight up ahead.
Congestion is a huge problem. In terms of lost productivity, it's a multi-billion dollar problem every year. But it's difficult to be precise about how big it is. Marion Terrell is the Transport Program Director at the Grattan Institute.
First of all, the Commonwealth Department of Infrastructure and Regional Development has produced some estimates, and they are that in 2010, congestion was costing $12.8 billion, and a prediction that by 2030 it would be $30 billion. Infrastructure Australia has also published estimates of the costs of congestion, and they're reasonably similar. They said $13.7 billion in 2011, right up to $53.3 billion in 2031. So that it's quite contested how these estimates are produced and how reliable they are, but I think in both cases what you can see is it's a big number.
It is a big number, but how would road pricing push it down? What's road pricing anyway? David Henscher is the founding director of the Institute of Transport and Logistics Studies at the University of Sydney Business School.
Road pricing is a language for identifying ways in which we should charge people to use roads. At the moment, the only charging we use is through a registration charge, which is basically an administrative charge, unrelated to usage, and a fuel excise, which is very lowly correlated with the type of traffic conditions in which you travel.
Hang on, David. What about toll roads?
I do want to make a distinction between the way in which we decide on pricing of toll roads versus what we badly need as a road pricing reform for the entire network. I think that distinction is very important, and many people who listen to the debate think of it in the context of tolls and toll roads, and that's nothing to do with network efficiency. In fact, what I think is important to note, that what government's really done, they've handed over pricing controls to the private sector on a small part of the network, which has denied the opportunity to price the whole network efficiently.
What David's talking about, what Marion Terrell's talking about, is something called economically efficient usage.
To use the infrastructure that we've got to maximise its usage while still allowing people to get around. If that's your goal, then what you're doing is, in technical terms, you're setting your price equal to marginal social cost. And what that means in layperson's terms is that on a congested road, when another driver decides to go out on the road, then they impose a cost on other people in the form of their little contribution to overall congestion. So if you charge for that extra little contribution to congestion, then it affects how people decide. Some people will still go ahead and drive. Some people might wait till later when it's not congested. Some people might not go at all. No trip is prohibited, but people make their own decisions about what's in their best interest because you align their interests with the social or the community's interests as a whole.
Which, if you think about it, sounds like exactly what we don't have.
We don't have any of that in this country, and it's pretty rare, really, around the world. We do have toll roads. We've got 16 toll roads in this country, but with minor exceptions, what they do is they have fixed tolls that don't vary according to the time of day. And that means if you drive at midnight when no one else is on that road, you're paying the same price as you are on a rainy Monday morning. So at best, it's a very crude form of congestion charge, but I think really it's hard to argue that it's a congestion charge at all. What those toll roads are seeking to do is to get some revenue from it, possibly the most that they can get, or the government-owned ones, perhaps some other amount. But basically, it's all about the revenue that you get rather than about encouraging efficient usage.
Any decision to change from what we have now can only be made by politicians.
I mean, this whole debate, be it tolling or pricing of road reform, is all about politics and buy-in. It's not about economics or engineering. This is the impasse we have. Many inquiries have recommended seriously improved reform because there's not enough money to maintain and build new infrastructure. And the general view is that users should contribute appropriately according to the benefits. So what we find at the moment, unlike other utilities, e.g. water and electricity, we have an appropriate pricing mechanism, peak off-peak, usage rates and so on and so on. We have none of that on roads.
But that doesn't mean it can't be done. Other places have already done it.
I've been driving in my car. It's not quite a Jaguar. I bought it in Primrose Hill.
London has done something. Stephen Joseph is chief executive of the British advocacy group Campaign for Better Transport.
Essentially, it's a cordon charge. If you drive into central London during the week, you pay £11.50 daily charge for driving a vehicle within the charging zone between 7 a.m. and 6 p.m. Monday to Friday. It's a cordon charge. It's not a charge by distance. It doesn't charge you per mile. It's a charge specifically to reduce congestion in central London.
When it came in 2003, the charge was very controversial. It still has plenty of critics and it's not perfect. But Stephen Joseph says it's had a huge impact.
You have to realise that London has seen a revolution in transport over the last 15 years. It's an extremely successful city economically. It's seen huge growth in housing and employment. And yet traffic in central London has gone down. You've seen an 11% shift away from the car towards public transport and a 10% reduction in traffic since 2000, but we've seen an increase in the number of journeys into central London. What we have seen is a huge decline in private car use in central London. However, two things have happened. Firstly, a lot of that car use has been replaced by vans and also by the growth of private hire vehicles, Uber and the like. But we've also seen policies that have been about effectively taking the benefits of the reduced private car use in terms of reduced road space, so for cars, so that, for example, to take a very famous example, the north side of Trafalgar Square has been pedestrianised. We've seen more bus lanes. We've seen famously and very controversially in the last year or two, introduced by Boris Johnson as a Conservative mayor, cycle superhighways. And so the congestion charge has in effect enabled a much larger change in the way in which people travel around London, especially in central London.
Congestion hasn't gone from central London, far from it, but increasingly it's not seen as the main problem.
The focus of policy debate on transport in London has shifted away from congestion towards air pollution. Oxford Street, not far from where I'm sitting now, is one of the most polluted streets in Europe. And the interesting thing is that the people calling for action to cut traffic, to pedestrianise Oxford Street, to have less freight vehicle or better managed freight vehicles, to have more cycling, are the business community, who argue that all the publicity around poor air quality puts people off investing and coming to London, that we need more walkable space rather than, you know, speeding up traffic.
The changes London has achieved, and as you're hearing, it's not just about road pricing, they've brought in a suite of measures, that's only been possible because of how the city is governed.
The way in which the mayoral system here works is that the mayor has to produce three strategies that all link together: a transport strategy, a London plan, which is a kind of development plan, a spatial plan for the whole city, and an economic plan. And the three work together and feed off each other so that, for example, in order to provide for new housing. The London plan is looking for development in the east end, the east of London, and is also, through the transport plan, planning new rail and underground extensions to serve that development. And I think the other thing that has worked in London and which has been recognised and, as I say, rolled out to other cities, is the need to look at a city-region scale. The remit of the mayor goes a long way out, which allows much more city-region planning than is the case in other cities.
To address the pollution and the congestion it still has, London's looking at introducing more levies, including what's called smart road charging.
The principle would be that the more you drive at peak times, the more you pay. And actually, that isn't very different from what happens on public transport. If you travel in the morning peak hour, you pay a lot more for your travel than you do if you travel after 9:30. So I think the idea is really to apply the same principle to roads as happens to public transport, allied with quite a lot of other measures to manage road use more generally, so that, for example, to try and see if deliveries can be moved outside the morning peak so they don't congest London roads so much. And we've already seen traders in, say, Bond Street coming together to reduce the number of waste contracts. Regent Street now has a sort of consolidation centre for goods transport. So I think smart road pricing is seen as part of a suite of measures to encourage that kind of behaviour.
This is The Money on RN, the ABC radio app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Addy. Today we're looking at road charging, so making motorists pay to use a road with the aim of discouraging congestion. David Hensher from Sydney University thinks he knows how to do it.
If you were to halve the registration charges that people currently pay, and let's say the average at the moment is close to $400, so we make it $200, I'm talking about Sydney at the moment, and then we introduce a peak charge of 5 cents a kilometre to use the roads, with no extra charge in the off-peak, we have been able to show that the majority of car users today in Sydney will be financially no worse off. But importantly, Treasury would be no worse off as well, and that's the big sell to the state politicians. And if that ever happened on the entire network, then we'd be identifying time savings. And then people would say, wow, my hip pocket's in good shape now, I'm no worse off, but look, I've got a time benefit. Once we get acceptance from the community, which is the votable product for the pollies, then we can start increasing that 5 cents a kilometre to raise additional revenue to be spent on improved roads, improved public transport and other areas.
That's critical, that the money raised is ring-fenced, so it can't go anywhere else.
There's a lot of evidence to suggest that the way you spend that money is a big sell on support for raising that money. If it goes into consolidated revenue, where you never see where it goes, could be wasted, you won't get a vote. The people who pay to use the roads under this model should get some benefit back by better roads. But the amount of revenue that will be raised as you go beyond the buy-in phase to a slightly higher increase, e.g. from 5 cents a kilometre to 6 cents a kilometre, that's about $5 billion extra income per year. That's big. And the good news about this is that this model will take 6% of the traffic off the road in the peak, and that's the equivalent of school holidays. And most people say in the school holidays, it's not bad.
It isn't. But how much choice would drivers actually have?
Any pricing reform must enable people to avoid it if they don't want to pay. And the beauty of having a peak-only price is that your alternative is the off-peak. And we know from studies that something like 70% of people do not have to travel in the peak, despite the view of the RMA, for example, that believes their only choice is to put up with a high price.
This is
big.
People have to get kids to school, they have to get to work.
But that's 30% of people that are restricted in the time of day they have to do these things. It's quite surprising how much flexibility there is in people's working times these days that they can do that. In fact, we see as traffic congestion gets worse, many people opting for the shoulders to avoid the horrendous traffic.
Okay, so you'd be charged per kilometre, but only in the peak times. and this would include every street right across the Sydney Basin. What's the technology, David?
GPS systems on all vehicles. It's a bit like generalising the toll road network in terms of capturing information. You can do it through satellites. You don't necessarily have to have the sophisticated technology built on the road, but in time, you might want to do that.
Right. And what would happen to the toll roads as we understand them now?
My view is that you should have a compensating strategy with the toll companies, given that they currently have a concession period of about 30 years, although some are well into their 30 years, that the revenue raised will be partly used to compensate them for the loss of toll income.
So if we implement this, the toll roads you would no longer pay to use, you just use? Or
it'll be part of the 5 cents a kilometre model. Yes, every road will be treated equally because we want network pricing, not toll road pricing. And we need to bring the pricing back to the control of government. What we have at the moment on toll roads is an agreed toll at the point of construction, which is CPI indexed, which is out of whack with the true value of travel time savings to get a benefit. So what we get congestion on toll roads, and we're paying a toll for a little benefit often these days, especially in the peak. The toll is wrong.
Certainly it seems that way when a tollway looks like a car park. Just thinking about David's plan, what are the problems with it? Marion Terrell says one might be privacy.
It seems like in this country we have a very active and effective privacy lobby. And depending on what technology is used, the concern that people have is that to be able to charge cars, you need to somehow track them, even if it's just through gantries like we have on freeways at present, or else through some in-car device. And the potential is there for this to be used for other purposes, particularly for surveillance.
And Marion has her own ideas on how a road pricing system should work.
What it should have in the design is vary by the time of day. Morning and afternoon peaks are very peaky, and so those are the times when congestion is far more acute. They should vary by location. Some parts of the city never get congested, and it doesn't make much sense to impose a congestion charge on people who drive on uncongested roads. And vehicle size. Bigger vehicles are more congesting, or they make a bigger contribution to congestion than smaller vehicles.
As in David Hench's plan, you'd only pay for travelling in the peak times. Marion also proposes charging more for larger vehicles. But where she really differs is that Marion wouldn't impose the charge in every street.
I guess you've got to find a practical point between the extreme of totally dynamic pricing, which has got the downside that people don't really know what price they're going to encounter before they go out, or on the other hand, prices that are fixed and hardly ever vary, then people might avoid the priced roads, do lots of rat running, for example, which is very annoying to local residents and creates congestion on smaller roads. If you don't price that, then again, you're not really achieving your objective. So realistically, I'm imagining that a way to do this would be to charge on urban highways or urban freeways and major arterial roads. I got a condo in Manhattan.
Baby girl, what's happening? You and your ass in my... We haven't talked about the biggest car culture in the world, America. Laura Bliss is a staff writer at CityLab, the Atlantic's spin-off covering urban affairs. Laura, how much is road pricing an issue in your country?
There's this sort of push to replace the federal gas tax in the United States with something called a VMT fee, which means vehicle miles traveled, also known as a mileage fee. That's basically just to replace the tax that is assessed on gas or fuel with a set rate based on the mileage that you travel. And then there's a sort of more local version of that, which is also charging, you know, per mile or depending on the geographic zone you enter or the road you take, but as a way to manage congestion. So there's kind of two different goals, right? And you can kind of think of them as relating to a city level and sort of a more regional or state level.
Nothing has happened on the smaller city scale. The politics has been too hard. But interestingly, ride-sharing giant Uber is now getting involved in the debate.
Uber's head of basically urban and transportation policy came out with a statement in support of a congestion pricing scheme, you know, within cities. And it was an interesting move. And I'll just say, too, that Lyft is sort of Uber's main competitor here. And they've not explicitly supported it, but they've sort of mumbled words suggesting that they might. And it definitely is consistent with the seeming like long-term business strategy of ride hailing in the United States. You see Uber and Lyft and other players definitely moving towards carpooling more and more, right? The app here in the States and most cities, it's just kind of default sets you to an Uber pool where you're riding with more than one other passenger. And so if you're not carpooling and you're in a city that has priced travel into downtown at peak times, you might be more tempted to hop in a carpool, right, in an Uber, because that means you're going to be splitting that cost with several passengers.
The real action is taking place at the state level.
The state of Oregon is almost 2 years into its pretty pioneering pilot program to gather somewhere close to 9,000 drivers statewide. And they have these drivers sort of voluntarily say, hey, you know, basically instead of paying your tax on, you know, every gallon of gas you buy, you can opt in to basically pay a couple of cents on the mile. And they gave drivers the option of either using kind of this high-tech location tracking device, a sort of lower-tech version where it was an odometer that really just counted the miles. And also drivers could sort of opt in to simply pay a sort of flat fee to participate. And again, this was in lieu of paying a gas tax. So the way that worked is that the drivers could opt in to participate and they would get a rebate basically for all the gas taxes that they were already paying. And this has been pretty successful, actually. I think I just read today that the program has seen like 85% of, or close to 9,000 participants, stay in the program. So people like it. And there is definitely talk in other state houses around the country to model something similar. California has also initiated a similar pilot. Connecticut was thinking about it. There's definitely plans to pilot a similar kind of setup in the works.
The reason for this enthusiasm? Well, the gas tax. It's supposed to pay for roads, but it's not raising enough money. Guess how much it is?
18 cents per gallon. That is a number that has not changed in more than 20 years, okay, since the Clinton administration. And that's mostly because it's just become a total political third rail. I mean, mostly for Republicans, but also for Democrats. You know, Republicans in this country, famously tax averse, Democrats hate the idea of raising what they see as a regressive fee. So it hasn't been raised. And meanwhile, right, so you have revenues that are already sort of less useful because of inflation, right? And then you also have vehicle fuel efficiency getting much, much better, right? So you have people just simply buying less gas. And you also have people driving less, right? Sort of since post-recession, we've seen, you know, declines in overall vehicle miles traveled in this country. And, you know, there's been some recovery since the economy has improved, but it seems to be declining overall. So the gas tax is just not working.
Today on The Money, we're looking at road pricing, which is aimed at reducing congestion. And what's clear is that it isn't a panacea. Marion Terrell from the Grattan Institute.
Road pricing is part of a solution, I would say, in a rapidly growing city, as the major capitals in Australia have been. In a rapidly growing city, you wouldn't expect this to do all the work of managing flows through the city. So you would expect to do some new infrastructure investment. But I do think encouraging people to fully use the network and to make use of flexibility that they might actually have allows us to sweat our assets a bit harder and delay investment that we might otherwise have to make. I think in addition to that, people do value public transport. They value having a choice, particularly in movements to the CBD. Public transport can be very efficient, certainly much more so than car travel.
Actually, that leads to another question. Can't public transport solve the congestion problem? David Hensher.
It is a good thing, but the amount that we will need to make a substantial difference is way beyond budget perspectives that are out there at the moment. It's not a matter of spending $10 billion or $20 billion. It's a matter of spending $100 billion or $200 billion to finally make a significant dent in the car culture. of course, you could just let congestion get worse and worse and worse on the roads. But at the moment, as that gets worse and worse and worse, crowding on the trains gets worse and worse and worse. So we have a dilemma. We're underinvested across all the modes. What are we going to do about it? I'm hoping that the revenue raised once we get buy-in on the roads, in part, not all of it, can be used to finance more significant public transport.
Which brings us back to politics.
They're totally the obstacle. The arguments have been well rehearsed for many, many years about how best to do it. That's why I've come round to the notion of buy-in. It's got to come back to, will it secure votes? And if it won't happen. What's good news, though, is that at least the politicians are talking about it now and trying to see how could we do it.
There's diabolical politics around this. Normal drivers are concerned at the idea that they might have to pay additional costs. And for that reason, politicians usually think about this in terms of a trade-off. So reducing other costs like fuel excise or registration costs, and instead introducing such a charge. And potentially, in addition to that, earmarking the revenue that they get from it, either for public transport to provide alternatives, or for new roads, or perhaps for both.
A point that's already been proven in London. And Stephen Joseph from Britain's Campaign for Better Transport says that's not all they've learned.
If you say to people, would you like to pay more for your motoring in a poll, they'll always reject you. If you introduce the charge for, say, an experimental period and then ask people whether they want it removed, they generally say no. And that happened in Stockholm, where the congestion charge similar to London's was introduced for an experimental period with all the extra bus services and so on, with a promise of a referendum afterwards. And so a year later, there was a referendum and people voted to keep it. And I think that that approach is probably the only way in which you can really get congestion charging in, when you actually show people what it actually means in practice and ask if they like it, rather than allow fear of the unknown to dictate what people think.
Ultimately, he says, we need to make a choice.
It's about what kind of city you want to be. Do you want to be a city dominated by cars and traffic and pollution? Or do you want a livable city which people can walk around and which feels like a nice city to live, work and invest in? And actually, a city dominated by cars isn't a good city for people to live, work and invest in. And I think London has shown the way in this respect, but I think there are lessons for Australian and other cities there too.
Stephen Joseph's the chief executive at Britain's Campaign for Better Transport. You also heard from Marion Terrell, director of the transport program at the Grattan Institute, David Hencher, founding director of the Institute of Transport and Logistics Studies in the University of Sydney Business School, and Laura Bliss, who's a staff writer at CityLab. Thanks to all of them. You'll find more on all of this at The Money's homepage. Just go to abc.net.au/rn. The Money's produced by Kate Piercy. Our sound engineer is Jennifer Parsonage, and I'm Richard Adie. Maybe you can drive my car. Yes, I'm gonna